Subcommittee on Ways and Means Safety to order. I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2340, the A engrossed version. I would call Mr. Neely and the Attorney General to the stand. Just as a little background, this is, as you are aware, we had the Attorney General's budget presentation in regard to the transfer of child support to the Attorney General's office from DHS, and so this is the bill that formally does that. This was something that was recommended last session, but I will let the Attorney General begin. Hardy.
Thanks very much, Chair Patrick and members. For the record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I'm joined by Jim Neely of the Department of Human Services. And thanks for the opportunity to offer just a few remarks in support of House Bill 2340. The Joint Interim Judiciary Committee instructed the Department of Justice and the Department of Human Services to work toward consolidation of the child support program into the Department of Justice. We formed an interagency child support interagency team, which operated through the interim and which, among other things, produced House Bill 2340. And today our two agencies are here jointly in support of that legislation. If approved, House Bill 2340 completes a process begun in 1997 when the legislature transferred the Child Support Accounting Unit from DHS to DOJ. And that change left only the Child Support Program Director's Office in DHS. And this measure brings that last part of the program to DOJ, thus merging policy and oversight responsibilities into the agency where 80% of the child support cases are administered. The other 20% are administered by district attorneys, and the Oregon District Attorneys Association has endorsed this measure. The change, we believe, will bring many benefits, but let me just briefly note those related to the cost effectiveness of the measure. First, consolidation will eliminate duplication of efforts and resources that have occurred in the past with program administrative staff in both DHS and DOJ working on the same issues, policy, legislation, budget, and so forth. And in looking at the elimination of duplication between the two agencies, not only will we be able to reduce the work done by, duplicated work done by multiple staffs, but it will also allow us to create new combinations of teams of program administrative staff who can be managed by Division of Child Support Managers. The consolidation will produce a $900,000 savings in general funds in the 2003-2005 biennium, due to the reduction in the number of staff as well as a reduction in the cost of overhead for the program. And Cindy Shinnock, the director of the Child Support Program, is available today if you have specific questions about the fiscal impact statement or the related policy packages. One additional note, we have one minor amendment pending which we bring before your subcommittee for consideration today. This is compared to the direction of the House Judiciary Committee when it reported the bill out to Ways and Means, and it addresses an issue raised by certain child support advocates. And Ronell Schenkel is available if you have any specific questions or concerns about the amendment. To sum up, this is, we think, a good government measure, but one of the most important, I think, the session will consider. And I respectfully ask the committee's support of the bill as a segue to your consideration of the Department of Justice's 2003-2005 budget, in which, as recommended by the governor, the budget changes that are entailed in the consolidation are provided for.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Mr. Neely?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Neely, Deputy Director of the Department of Human Services. I would just add that I think we've had just tremendous cooperation between these two departments in the interim, and I think we've worked out just about every issue that has come to us. I think this is the right thing to do, and I think the bill you have in front of you now is the right way to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Neely. Questions? All right. Any further members of the audience that wish to testify in relation to House Bill 2340 or the associated amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I'd like to have Ms. Schenkel come forward, if I could, please, to have her just make one assurance on this particular bill. I know that she's been out on sick leave. She bumped herself up pretty badly. Fell off of a giant ladder or something. Wasn't secured to the ceiling. Ronell, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Right.
Thank you very much. Ronell, I, you and I have worked through the interim on a piece of legislation to try and help, in the collection of child support payments and the assistance of private enterprise in that process. In any way, will this, as A, engrossed, or as we're potentially considering as B, engrossed, will any of this modify the work which we've done in trying to encourage the support of private industry to come in and help the Attorney General's office in providing these child support services?
Chair Partridge, Representative Butler, absolutely not. That opportunity still exists, and that partnership will continue to go forward.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. We're now, hold on just one second. I know you want to get out of the hot seat.
It's not that hard.
Senator George.
I had someone in my office yesterday, and the question, and they were telling me a little bit about their life history, and four children that she raised on her own, and a husband that has a job, lives in California, has never been able to collect anything. Are we going to be able to do anything to make sure that when instructions are ordered relative to a divorce, that in fact the children are... because this person lived in poverty for a great number of years until she finally got her education.
Chair Patridge, Senator George, our interstate cases have been some of the most difficult cases. I will tell you briefly that the Oregon legislature has adopted the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. It's found in our Chapter 110. It does strengthen our ability and the reciprocity actions available between the states, and I'd be happy to meet with you or someone in your office and talk further about that.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks. Any other questions before we let Ronell leave?
All right. Thank you, Ronell. Okay, at this point in time, there's seeing nobody else in the audience, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2340, and I will wait to open a work session on House Bill 2340 until such time as the good senator from West Lynn arrives.
And we're also trying to find a co-chair to vote if Senator Devlin cannot be found.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
One question relative to the proposed amendments, the -8.
Can we wait until, because we didn't open a work session.
Right.
So
can we ask any questions about them?
Yeah, we will when we go to the work session.
All right. I just don't want to open a work session without the quorum of the members being here. There's always the issue of that with only two senators. What's the quorum issue?
All right.
That's our only
well, at this point in time, then, just so that the audience knows, the chair has to go testify to a committee, as does Representative Butler. At some point in time, we're going to hold here until we get Senator Devlin or a co-chair, and then we'll go into work session quickly, answer any questions, and then see what we can do. So I apologize to everyone, but at this point in time, I will then, so with that in mind, I will then reopen the public hearing on House Bill 5049, which is the DPSST budget. Diane was here yesterday, and I think we...
Schrader's on his way.
Okay, Senator Schrader currently on his way, so...
Diane, were you going to come back with some responses first?
I think what I would do with your permission is factor those into the rest of the presentation at the appropriate places, and then I have a couple at the end that really don't fit in too well any place. I'll cover those, and then I have a couple that I'll still need to get to you in final form, if that would work.
Okay.
And you may even add something.
All right.
Okay. With that, we were beginning on to go through the program services, and we're in the criminal justice and training and certification section. We can kind of start at page 12, if that works. As I indicated yesterday, in the training division, there are basically two main sections to that, which is academy training and the regional training. Some important features in that, I think, is to recognize that the training division handles instruction for basic, intermediate, advanced, supervisory, management, executive, and then the specialized training as well. What's significant here in terms of our operation, I think, is the fact that we make use of what we refer to as agency part-time trainers, also contractors and volunteers, to get this job done. We have just a few training coordinators. Their job is to make sure that the classes are organized. They also do some instruction. Most of them are certified officers and do have either a law enforcement, a corrections, a parole and probation background, or a telecom background if they're in the criminal justice side. The agency part-time trainers are typically full-time officers with other agencies. And so when they come to work with us, they're working as part-time employees for the state, but they do have a full-time job elsewhere. But this has been a very efficient way for us to train in that it allows us to make sure that the people who are training are very current in their skills, as well as allows us a much larger pool to select from. We do use about 350 part-time trainers, volunteers, and coordinators to get the training mission accomplished. One of the questions that Representative Hansen asked yesterday was, how do we figure out how many classes we're going to do, how many people we need to train? That's not easy, given the number of factors that are involved. But what we do on an overall basis...
Can we stop you there, then,
sure.
Diane, while we have Senator Devlin here?
Yep.
Nice of you to visit, Senator Devlin. I appreciate it.
Oh, come on. I was late, too. So.
We're going to temporarily suspend the hearing on House Bill 5049 until we complete the work session. At this point in time, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2340A, the A-plus version. Senator or Representative Butler, I believe you had a question,
Mr.
on
Chair,
the Dash A2 amendments.
The Dash A2 amendments are on page 2, line 21. The insertion of the director shall ensure the child support policy and rules to maximum extent applicable meet the needs of the majority of families served by the program. The director shall guide the program staff regarding implementation policy and rules. No mention is made as to cost effectiveness. I assume that that is a given, but in the past it has not. The maximum number of families can be served if you have the absolute unlimited number of dollars. I just want for the record to understand that, in fact, we are talking about the optimum number of families with the dollars that are available.
I think that's to the maximum extent practicable.
Absolutely.
And that takes into account resources that the state and the federal government, I think, are able to put in.
With that, Mr. Chair, I would move that the Dash A2 amendments be appended to the bill.
Representative Butler moves the Dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2340. Are there any objections? They're adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move 2340 be moved to the full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Butler moves House Bill 2340A as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Seeing none. So ordered.
I'll just carry.
Okay.
And on the Senate floor?
On the Senate floor, well, I think that they'll decide it. You want to carry on the Senate floor?
Yes.
Senator Devlin? Okay. At this point in time, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2340, and I will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 5049. And Diane, I believe you were in the middle of a question that was asked by Representative Hansen, so I'm going to turn the gavel over to him, and I'm sure he will keep you occupied until we're all able to return.
Okay, as I was saying, the question that was before us was how do we determine the numbers and the amount of training so that we can budget and plan classes, basically. And we do it on two levels. The first is we take a five-year overview because there are often peaks and valleys. A lot of that depends on the hiring in particular agencies or the retirements that have happened in a particular agency. Such as a few years back, Portland did a massive hiring and increase, and they brought on some 80 officers at one time, so you have to factor those in. Same thing was true with corrections as they opened facilities. There was a huge peak in training, but that's not necessarily how it sits. So we usually look at about a five-year period of time. The other thing that we do is every 6 months, as we're planning the next 6 months of the training schedule, we survey local agencies to see what they anticipate in terms of their hiring, so we get kind of a checks and balances as we go along. One of the issues that we had, as you heard mentioned yesterday, was back in 96 through about 98, we had a backlog in training, and that meant that we were not able to provide enough training to get officers in after they were hired. The slots were just full. We took care of that, but the way we have now been able to prevent having that happen again is we typically will schedule an additional class in case we have to add, and then we filter it back through. So we schedule it, even though we think we probably won't fill, so if we have to, we can make it work. There's no additional resources put to it. It's merely a scheduling mechanism to make sure that we can do it if we have to. So we always plan ahead for that. Sometimes it's not essential because we can tell from the responses that we get back on the surveys that there's no peak anticipated of any kind, there's no correctional institution opening up in the near future, and then we don't need to do that. So that's kind of how we monitor it on a couple of different levels. And I have that actually written for you if you like that. A couple of other points I think that are noteworthy in the training. One of the things we don't, while we do have the basic training at each of the different levels for each of the different disciplines, as you've heard repeatedly, basic police is at 10 weeks trying to get to 16. Corrections is at 5 weeks. They've been wanting to get to 7, but they're at 5 weeks at this point. Basic parole and probation is 4 weeks in length. Telecommunications is 2 weeks. And your emergency medical dispatch is a two-day follow-up to that. Campus public safety is 5 weeks, and leadership is typically approximately a two-week program. That one is actually in transition. We have found that the 2 weeks for supervisors and new supervisors and managers to be away from their agencies is too much right in the beginning, so we're breaking that into components, only a portion of which will be done at the academy, and the rest would be delivered regionally in the local areas. The other thing that we do is we have a career officer development course, and this is for officers who come with prior experience from another state. We actually have reciprocity with a number of states, and we know from their training where it relates to ours, and then what we do is bring them in for 2 weeks so they're acclimated to Oregon law, which is can be very unique in some respects. So that's one efficiency. The other thing we do is if a person has been out of the law enforcement or the corrections field for more than 2.5 years, that's used as a refresher course and allows them to recertify. The regional training, as we mentioned, is designed as advanced and specialized training. It also, because we cannot get to 16 weeks, we have used it to try and cover some of those topics that we can't reach during basic training. It's delivered, as its name implies, throughout the state. We have 11 regional training councils. What we have been attempting to do as a part of our strategic business plan is get one in each of the regions, and we've been putting on approximately 2 to 3 per biennium. We unfortunately have not been able to increase that program, and in fact in this biennium are going backwards and will be losing one of those positions, which I will comment on later. In the regional training area, we have an office that's located in Cornelius. It's our Northwest Field Office. It has it actually sponsors or helps 73 different criminal justice agencies, and it's located in Clackamas, Clatsop, Columbia, Tillamook, and Washington. The southern office is located at Central Point, and it responds to 69 criminal justice agencies in Coos, Curry, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, and Klamath. The Eugene office, which is the one in the governor's balanced budget that is due to be eliminated and closed, represents 75 criminal justice agencies located in Benton, Lane, Lincoln, Lynn, Marion, Polk, and Yamhill. The Central Oregon office is located in Lapine. It handles 37 criminal justice agencies, and they're Crook, Deschutes, Harney, Lake, and Jefferson counties. The Eastern Oregon Field Office is located in Pendleton, and it handles 55 criminal justice agencies in Baker, Grant, Malheur, Morrow, Umatilla, Union, and Wallowa counties. And then we have the Salem Office, which handles 89 criminal justice agencies located in Gillam, Hood River, Multnomah, Sherman, and Wheeler counties. So you can tell they're fairly well dispersed around the states. It is a pretty significant task for them to cover the amount of territory, especially the eastern Oregon and southern Oregon areas. But that has been a very successful program. It was a program that was very much called for by our local agencies as a way to deal with an inability to keep officers' maintenance training up to par. I know most of you are familiar with our regional training trailers, and what those have done is allow us to get skills to the more remote areas. The Standard Certification Division, it's actually made up of six units, and I'm on page 14 at this point. Four of those units are in the criminal fines and assessment account. They include the job task analysis unit, the curriculum unit, the accreditation unit, and the certification and records unit. Also covered by this section is private security and fire certification, but they're under a different funding source. What this unit is responsible for a number of things, beginning with the job task analysis, which is the overview of every single discipline to determine what are the core functions of that particular discipline, how often do they occur, what's the risk when they occur, and from that you develop the performance measures that create the curriculum, which then create the training and create the testing. So it's the basis of all of that for every discipline. Ideally, a job task analysis completed every 5 years for each discipline. So it's a rotation, and it's continually updated. This particular unit, as I indicated, handles curriculum development, and we do that by using subject matter experts who are working in the professions, as well as citizens. As I mentioned, part of our curriculum incorporates communications, it incorporates community policing, it incorporates ethics and diversity, and so we try to get input from people other than law enforcement to make sure we're meeting the mark. So they participate in work groups that help design the curriculum, make sure those components are in there and are covered in a way that makes sense for the delivery of the curriculum to officers in their communities. The other thing we have to be very conscious of is that the curriculum we develop is legally defensible. When an officer or when an incident goes wrong, as you know, it often ends up in court, and there are times when we are then called in to explain what they were taught in terms of a situation such as that and how they handle it, how they were taught to handle it and what the curriculum is. We also do the course accreditation, and that's for not only the mandatory courses, but for courses that are taught by other entities, such as Portland State University currently has one of the management programs that we do offer certification for, as well as the students are getting college credit and working usually towards an upper division degree. We also have worked with them to make sure all the elements in order for them to get their supervision or management certificate are included in their curriculum, and then we accredit it for that. We certify the instructors, which has become a very key component. We try to make sure that instructors that are going out to do training, especially if they're representing the state, do meet the minimum qualifications for instructors, and that's a fairly detailed process. We also do probably what's not as a favorite topic for many folks is the decertification or revocation of certifications when something has gone wrong. This is a process that we work very diligently with the board. There are some things, such as certain crimes, that are mandatory disqualifiers, and once there's a conviction, we just revoke their certification. There are other areas that are discretionary disqualifiers, and those take a little more discussion. And what we look at is, does that person have the moral character? Does the conduct that they engaged in bring disrespect to the profession? They look at all those things. It's a very formal process, and determine whether or not that person should maintain their certification. As kind of a side note, we do also participate in the national decertification base, which is run through the International Associations of Directors of Law Enforcement Standards and Training. The standard certification, as noted on page 15, also deals with the administration of polygraph and licensing. And, of course, the review of sheriff's candidates for eligibility to run for office. The program measures are mentioned on page 15 also, the performance measures, and we have two of them in the criminal justice. It's kind of deceptive. There's actually one for each of the disciplines, but what we're looking at in those is the level of officer performance. In other words, are we producing the product that the agency needs when they finish basic training? And we do that through working with the field training officers and the agency leadership to make sure in a number of categories that we have met the mark in the training. The other part of that is the quality of our records that we have available. Many times an officer, when they are challenged in court, will need to produce their training record and have it validated that they've, in fact, had the training that was necessary and the required numbers of hours if it happened to be a mandated training. I think we talked yesterday about the factors that affect our service and the challenges that we have there. And as you can see on page 17 and 18, we have a lot of partnerships in order to get this job done. Bill McGee went over our expenditures, and I covered our program growth factors yesterday in our history and overview. If we take a look at page 22, that gets into the reductions that are planned at this point as a part of the governor's balanced budget. There is a total elimination of 15 positions, which is 14.75 FTE. Four of those positions are out of regional training, the assistant director of regional training, two public safety training specialists, and an office specialist, too. As I indicated, this will eliminate the office in Eugene that serves 75 criminal justice agencies, and it will also close the regional field office in the North Valley, which serves another 89 of those agencies. I should indicate also in this that it will obviously have a significant toll on the amount of training that we will be able to accomplish. Also, most of our terrorism and first responder to terrorist acts is by this unit, so that will become even more challenging. That's probably, and as of late, one of our more popular topics that people are requesting. In the accreditation unit, three positions are eliminated. That's the entire accreditation unit, the supervisor, the coordinator, and the support specialist. This will completely eliminate this unit, which means we will not be able to accredit other entities outside of the basic training that has to be done. Obviously, we won't be adding to the group that are accredited. And in addition, this is the group that also handles our instructor certification. That's a piece that is so significant that we're probably going to have to reduce duties in another location to get that covered somehow, or at least a portion of it. In the curriculum and distance learning unit, five positions were eliminated. The two distance learning positions and the technical support were actually a part of the shortfall. But in addition, we have lost the testing coordinator and the curriculum training liaison and the curriculum sports specialist. So this will very drastically reduce our ability to complete the work on the 16 weeks. We have been doing that over time, developing not only the curriculum, but a complete program of scenarios that the instructors can use and be trained on. So that they can be adjusted. This unit also creates the scenarios for testing so that they are standardized and uniform. So this will create some significant hardship over the next couple of years. Two positions were eliminated from the business services unit. This is the accounting technician 2 and the administrative specialist 1. This will create a major workload issue. One of these positions is scheduled, the accounting technician 2, to potentially be returned, but the funding has not been determined on that at this point. It's a section where we have just a very few people in our business services office, and the workload there without the facility is pretty significant. With the facility, it's overwhelming. And so that's the reason the One Tech 2 position is scheduled to come back. One of my biggest concerns, I guess, is as an agency, and I'll add just a little tidbit of history here to this, too, is when I came to the agency, there was it was a very difficult agency to manage and get my arms around because there was so little available in terms of bookkeeping and accounting and those kinds of things to understand what things cost. Shortly after I arrived, the business manager retired, then had another business manager who came for a short period of time who was beginning to grasp the concept, and unfortunately she had a very significant illness which took her away and she was not able to return to work. We filled in, thanks to the help of Department of Administrative Services, with a person for a period of time who then retired, and then finally we got a business manager, and we are finally getting an accounting system so that we can really figure out what it does cost to do business and where we can find efficiencies. So, and one of the things that she's been really instrumental in doing is making sure we have in place what are good accounting practices and principles that protect us from errors and audits and those kinds of things. And I would hate to lose that as we move forward, but it looks like we'll lose a piece of it. We also lost a position in academy training. This is a position that worked closely with the curriculum unit, and I'm on page 24 at this point. And this person was developing the transition plan to get instructors in classrooms into the 16 weeks. Of all the positions that we're losing, this one probably does the least damage to us because of the delay in the facility. We can bring this on at a later date and get caught up. It eliminates 50% of the funding for child abuse training. Our child abuse training handles all the multidisciplinary training. It also sponsors people from the local units will go as a multidisciplinary team to a training that is only held in San Diego, and people from all across the country go to this. We try to send approximately 2 teams a year, and it's their job when they come and represent their community. The child care worker also goes a part of this team, the state child care worker, as well as the local folks. And when they come back, it is their job to bring back that training and, in essence, be a trainer around the state from their year's work. So we will be losing part of that in this. It eliminates the funding for the DARE program, the Drug Abuse Resistance Education, completely. That will not be offered in the state. The only place people will be able to get that now will be to go to another state. It does eliminate the Public Safety Executive Training Seminar. This is a training seminar that we do for public safety leadership once a year, typically in the winter. It usually covers about 250, 300 public safety executives. Not only do we have training at that seminar, but we take care of a number of the leadership meetings that occur, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Executive Development Institute Association, the FBI, State Police, our policy committees and the board all get their meetings done during this same time. So it ends up being a statewide work session that occurs. This is something that's been occurring for about 15 years and will be eliminated as of this year. Next year, I guess. The Oregon Executive Development Institute is the only command college that we do, and that's done in conjunction with the FBI. That, too, will be eliminated. It's been ongoing for 14 years. Now, I'm saying the program will be eliminated. Our portion of the program will be eliminated, which has always been a fairly significant portion in terms of organization and providing some funding. Both of those two, I will tell you, do recover fees from the attendees. We're getting close to them covering full costs, but haven't quite gotten there. But both of those are fee-based. In addition to that, there's various services and supplies that are eliminated, as well as the SNS that went to the Oregon State Police specialized training courses that they held at the Monmouth facility. It basically covered their student week costs when they were at that location. It indicates the funding that went along with, eliminates the distance learning funding that went along with those two positions that were eliminated. Our resource center, which is in essence a lending library, will no longer be funded, and the staff is reduced from that as well. And it eliminates the capital outlay, so we will not have monies available to replace obsolete training equipment or to require replacement or updated equipment. And we will not be doing replacement of computers. I think we have those on like a 5 or 6 year cycle at this point. I think those are the big items in there. In the enhancement packages, we have the traffic safety coordinator, which is a grant that comes to us through the Department of Transportation. And then we have the additional transfer for the additional 911 training that was required. That was kind of prearranged prior. That gets us through, I think, criminal justice. And if we can flip...
Quick question on the 911 training.
Mm-hmm.
Do you... I'm assuming you've recover all the costs for that program, the 911 tax.
The 911 tax covers the cost of the program.
Does that also cover a prorated percentage of the administrative costs?
Representative Hansen, it does cover that. We can switch to fire, which starts at page 28 under the fire tab. The fire training, as I indicated yesterday, is handled a little bit differently. It is almost completely done on a regional basis, and that is because of the numbers of volunteer firefighters, and so we try to meet their training schedules with nights and weekends, and it's all across the state. There are 22 regional fire training associations. We obviously don't have nearly that many training coordinators. There are basically 49 certifications. Their training is very different from police training, in that a fire officer may not have all of the certifications, so their program is broken down into interests and duties, so they don't necessarily have an overall training like they would as a police officer. It would be much like if your police just were trained to be an investigator or were just trained to be a canine or were just trained to be a patrol officer, which is not what we do in law enforcement, but that is how fire works, and that works well because of the variety, I think, of disciplines, and because they're working with volunteers who then can specialize in a particular area. You have a couple of the areas noted for you there, but just to give you an example of some of the certifications, not only is there the basic firefighter certification, but there's driver apparatus, airport firefighter, there's the instructor, hazardous materials responder, a fire investigator, a fire inspector, a public education specialist, a fire ground leader, a maritime fire operator, a rescue technician, juvenile fire setter intervention, and those have degrees and levels within them, but that's basically how that works, and that's why it works fairly effectively to do it on a regional basis and to do it in shorter programs. And I think the programs vary in length, anywhere from an hour to 120 hours or so. The Fire Service Training Unit has a training and a certification section. The Fire Service Training Unit also serves as the state liaison for the U.S. Fire Administration and the National Fire Academy. DPSST does facilitate a 2-day class that's delivered regionally for the National Fire Academy. The other thing I think that's significant is because of our close ties with the National Fire Academy, we have been able to get at least 150 volunteers in for that training at almost no cost to the state. The National Fire Academy will cover that cost for those volunteers. About all they need to pick up is their meals. They do their transportation there, they do their housing, they do their work. So that's really advantageous for us to be able to get that many seats. The The same system holds true for both career and volunteer firefighters. So what we have adopted in Oregon with the help of our Fire Advisory Policy Committee is that we have gone from having individual Oregon state standards to adopting the national standards wherever possible. And so the ones that we have left in Oregon are things that are unique to Oregon, and that helps significantly in our ability to get training. It standardizes training nationally, which makes it possible for us to pick up more CAN programs. There is no such thing as a national training standard in law enforcement. It just doesn't exist. Let's see. Basically, what we have is four regional training coordinators now for fire. We used to have five. They're located in Central Point, Lapine, Pendleton, and Salem. And we ended up, due to the shortfall in the fire insurance premium tax, we lost the position that was in Cornelius. I think as you get to the bottom of page 30, I think you're fairly well versed on the issues that we have with the fire insurance premium tax. I know that Bill McGee has gone over that with you. This also does an intra-fund transfer from the fire insurance premium tax into CFAA for administrative overhead. One of our biggest concerns and part of the strategic planning that we had done with the fire service is to look at what it would really take to do this job right, and that's what the paragraph on page 31 talks about. And as you can see, it would take about 22 FTE to do the job right. We're not even close to that. At this point in time, what we're trying to do with the program, obviously, is to try and maintain it. There's no possible way that we can move forward and expand it. What's sad about that is, as noted in that paragraph, essential training for volunteer and career firefighters is provided fairly sporadically, and that less than 40% of the state fire service community is certified even as a firefighter one. So that means we have a lot of people that really don't have the kind of training that they need to respond to fires. We did have a budget note in this particular area, as LFO indicated, and we responded to that in April of 2002, having to do with the fire insurance premium tax and what the solutions might be for that. And as you're aware, there is some legislation pending and at least had its first hearing, and they're still working on a resolution. The insurance company has been very supportive and very helpful in helping us come to a solution for that shortfall. And that concludes the fire service area, unless there's any question. I'll keep moving on. Private security then hits under the next heading and begins at page 34. As indicated earlier, this is completely supported by fees from the industry and from the participants. This was created back in 1995 when the industry came forward to the legislature wanting to be regulated, wanting to improve its professional image and its credibility, and also wanting to promote acceptance among the law enforcement community. As law enforcement was struggling with funding, and it has been since 1995, agencies were finding they couldn't handle all the duties they had traditionally done in their communities, and what was happening was private security was backfilling for some of those needs. And with that, they wanted to improve their working relationship with law enforcement, and with that, they came to what was then the Board on Police Standards and Training and asked to be a part of the agency. That did occur in 1995. One of the challenges in working with the private security industry is there's a lot of fluctuation in terms of companies coming and going, in terms of employees that come in for a short time duration, maybe just for a particular project or an assignment. They will often work seasonal workers. They were very concerned about some of the noncompliance issues and the challenge of the private-public sector blend. When a business needs to make a decision, sometimes they can make it quickly, and sometimes we have to come back to the legislature to make it. So the decisions and the changes are not quite as quick, but we have developed over the last few years what I consider to be a very good working relationship. And as I indicated, the Private Security Advisory Committee worked when we told them that it appeared that we would be reaching a shortfall in their budget. They came forward and worked with us to find a solution. Today, Harold Burke-Sivers is here. He is an industry representative. He is the Director of Public Safety at the University of Portland. He also serves on the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training and is the chair of the Private Security Advisory Committee. And I know you had some questions about yesterday about the fee increase there, and so he's here to answer that from his perspective, if that would be appropriate.
For the record, Harold Burke-Sivers, Director of Public Safety at the University of Portland, Chair of the Private Security Advisory Committee, and a member of the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training.
Are there questions at this point?
I think the questions were around the industry support for the fee, and
yeah,
make sure all the
sure.
that the industry did agree with
yes.
the agency.
Yeah, Representative Hanson, members of the committee, we meet quarterly, and last year during one of our quarterly meetings, we usually asked to see what our budget projection is for the next biennium. During one of the meetings last year, we were presented with our first deficit. We've been operating since 1995, and for the 2003-2005 biennium, we were actually presented with a loss. And so we looked at that, and we asked DPSSC to work with us to present us with some scenarios of how we could cover that loss. And so we were presented with about a dozen scenarios. We worked that down to half a dozen, down to three. And it was very important to us that we minimize the impact to the frontline officer, to those officers that are trying to support their families making $8, $9, and $10 an hour. Rather, we saw it was important to spread the bulk of that increase amongst the executive managers, of which I am one, who have ultimate authority for compliance at their particular agency and their particular private security entity, as well as the instructors and those other people who actually make a profit off of training the private security officers. So we felt the bulk of that increase should fall upon those groups and not on the officers themselves. Also, we looked at this with an eye toward actually reducing the fees back down to the original levels, maybe one or two biennia for now, as we bring more companies into compliance and then broaden our fee base. By having more companies into compliance, we have a broader range, and therefore we can reduce the fees back down to the original level. So that was our thinking when we came up with our fee increases.
What would your what do you think your compliance factor is? 80%, 60%?
Representative Hanson, members of the committee, I would say right now it's kind of hard to put an actual number on it because we can gauge it more by which industry. For example, we know there are a number of retail industries that are not fully in compliance as opposed to some of, say, manufacturing, which is almost totally in compliance. So it's more by the type of industry. And so what we've done now that we have an investigator trainer, where we've basically instructed that person to focus more on the investigative piece, to work with our administrative rules to bring to administer civil penalties to those companies that are not in compliance in order to bring them into compliance. So we're looking at particular industries that are not in compliance as rather as to a whole big picture.
Getting off real easy. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
As a point of interest, I think Mr. Burke-Sivers has been with the program from the very beginning and has watched it grow. The initial thought was that they would probably have around 4,000 private security people be certified or licensed, and I forget where we are now, like 24,000 or something like that. It's an incredible number. But that's part of the reason it's had growth. And we're just now to the point where everyone has had plenty of time to understand what the rules are. And, in fact, I think at the April board meeting, some of the first civil penalties will be going forward, seeking permission to go forward on that. So we're about to find out how that works.
Senator George.
I'm going to move out of the area we're in, but I want to ask just a philosophical question, and that is we see these folks stepping out of private security and saying, okay, we'll pay the additional cost to make sure we maintain the training. Are you getting that same sort of input from departments, agencies for police and fire that are saying, look, we don't want these cuts to go into effect. We want to maintain the program by coming up with some fee mechanism for their officers or their departments?
Representative Hansen, Senator George. Not really, and I think that's because the funding source is different in that for the local agencies, they would have to go back to city commissioners, county commissioners, those kinds of things, versus a business decision on how they want to regulate themselves. One of the things that happens here as well in private security is other than training an instructor and the trainer, we don't really put them through a training program. The industry takes care of that themselves.
Follow-up question? Dan, would it be reasonable to expect that a person who's gone through and certified up would be looking towards possible increase in their wages or benefits, not benefits necessarily, but when they get back to their department, would they expect to have additional increase in wages because of their training?
Representative Hansen, Senator George, are you talking about like a law enforcement officer or a...
Yeah, law enforcement, fire department. I mean, for example, you know, a teacher who goes out and gets additional education, and then boom, up they go in an increase. And I was just wondering if the same thing applied to fire and police.
You know, I'm probably not the best person to answer that, and maybe when Sheriff Burright speaks later, he might respond to that. But my sense is that it varies depending on the particular contracts in the agencies. I think some contracts do have incentives for learning. I don't know of many that have incentives like for finishing their basic, because that's kind of you can't be even certified to do your job until you get that under your belt. So I don't imagine there's much there, but there may be other things. But I would have to think that's probably varies from agency to agency. Okay, then we can maybe move on to the Memorial Fund. And I think what I might do in this particular area is ask Deputy Director Alan Sharn to come up. He has worked most closely with this particular program. And as you know, it's fairly complex in its nature and also undergoing some potential change.
Chair Patridge and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alan Sharn. I'm the Deputy Director of DPSST. And this program, the Memorial Fund program, got started in 1999, and it was retroactive back to 1997. The first thing that we did, first of all, I'd like to note that this is a separate program funding-wise from DPSST. Our role in the Memorial Fund is strictly to help the board, which is a separate board from our main board, to administer the program. So in as much as we assist the board in administering the program, we developed the administrative rules to go along with the statute and got started in reviewing requests for benefits in 1999 and late or early 2000. The fund pays a total of four different benefits. They pay a $25,000 death benefit to eligible family members of officers killed in the line of duty, just killed in the line of duty. They also offer health and dental benefits to family members for the wife up to 5 years and for children up to age 23 if they remain in school. And that's if other benefits are not available. They also offer a tuition benefit for the wife, or I should say the spouse, not the wife. It could be the husband. And also for the children for undergraduate work. And also mortgage benefits for up to 12 months. That's how the program sits right now. I can give you a little bit of history about some legislation that we've got pending right now, if you would like to hear about that. Okay.
Senator Devlin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had one question, and reading through this, it's kind of underlying the print. It's almost there's an implication here that the current costs are covered other than the inflationary adjustments, but is that the actual case? I mean, obviously, we would not know of the unfortunate circumstances of another law enforcement officer or firefighter dying, actually. But in terms of the current recipients, does this budget amount actually cover what we anticipate being the cost of covering those services?
It has so far, but your question's very good, because I think that the board, looking at these peaks and valleys in since 1997 in the number of officers that have been killed or disabled in the line of duty, and looking at what the program is responsible for paying, decided to look at some legislation to change the payment benefits around a little bit to try to make sure that there was going to be monies available down, you know, looking 10, 20 years into the future. So that's a difficult question to answer at this point, but I can give you some information on some research we did, or the board did, surrounding preparing some legislation to try to address this. Okay.
Thank you, Senator. Go ahead.
Okay. What we did was we did some research on what the fund currently offers as far as benefits, and we projected that out 24 years, and also what the program would offer under House Bill 2238. And the original proposal under 2238 was to do away with the four different types of benefits and to pay in a lump sum, two-time lump sum. The $25,000 benefit would go to any eligible family member of an officer killed in the line of duty or disabled in the line of duty, and then they had an option of coming back within a year and requesting up to an additional $75,000, depending on what other benefits the family members had received during that year period of time. Projected out... hang on a second, let me get to the right page here. Looking out to 2025 in that biennium, under the current structure, the Memorial Fund would need just over $10 million in it to fund it under the current system. Under the proposed changes in House Bill 2238, the fund would need just slightly over $1 million to fund it. That was the, I guess, the primary driver in wanting to change the legislation to be able to offer something to the family members, but not totally deplete all the funds and not have anything for anybody. The main driver in cost for this particular fund, as it sits right now, is the health and dental benefits. Those are available to, as I mentioned before, to children up to age 23 if they stay in school. And right now we have 24 children in the program, I guess you would say, of officers that have been killed or disabled in the line of duty. So when you project those out over the 25 years, it's a huge amount of money. And I will tell you that we have been working, we went to Judiciary on the, I think, 7th of March with this proposed legislation, and there was some opposition to the two-time lump sum payment structure. So the Judiciary Committee asked us to go form a work group with the folks that had some opposition to that, and also the Governor's Office, to look at some different ways that we could look at paying the benefits out of the fund and still make sure that there was going to be money in the future to do that. That's kind of where we are today. We're looking at different ways to change that language around a little bit, still provide a benefit, but not completely deplete the fund.
All right. Mr. Chair, there was a question yesterday, I believe, by Representative Butler around what other benefits are available in this handout.
that either the department or DAS have prepared and coming back to you with responses to.
We'll make sure Representative Butler does his homework. There will be a test tomorrow. Diane, if you could put together a
brief test for Representative Butler, we'd appreciate it. The committee would appreciate it. All right. Any further questions?
Just one.
Senator Devlin.
In terms of these different categories, it says eligible beneficiaries in many of them. What is the status for, like, volunteer firefighters who lose their life in the line of duty, or reserve officers, although I think it's more after volunteer firefighters?
For the Oregon benefits, for this fund, they're eligible to receive the same benefits. And if you're referring to the document that has all the different benefits that are available, in many cases, those reserves or volunteer firefighters are eligible for those benefits as well, including the federal benefit, the one-time payment of, I think it's $262,000.
Thank you, Senator. All right. At this point in time, we'll go ahead and proceed. Diane?
Okay. Thank you. The next section is the capital construction beginning on page 39. We went over much of the history that led us to this point yesterday, and I think we could probably skip ahead. There's a brief summary of, as LFO indicated yesterday, we've been to the emergency board many, many times. There's a brief history outlining that. We have responded to a number of different notes and requests. All of those things were completed as of October, and in October is when we received the full authority to move forward with the project. On page 41, you'll also note that at the time this document was prepared, that we were still waiting for the conditional use permit and the urban growth area permit. We have both of those at this point in time. The hearings have been conducted in Salem. The appeals process has passed, and so we have accomplished that. As you look at page 42, I think I mentioned it a little bit yesterday, but I can't help but say it again, because I want the people of Oregon to know the work that the steering committee and the oversight groups have put into this particular project. We started by looking at a number of facilities across the state. There are very few that bring all their disciplines to one location and make that opportunity available to them. There are very few states that I think have incorporated the efficiencies that Oregon has by having them under one single umbrella and not duplicating some of the administrative overhead. But the Georgia facility in particular, I just want to make sure that people understand that they're basically accomplishing the same function, but it took them 1,000 acres to do it. Now, I will tell you, there's a lot of space between their facilities. But one of the things that they did, and Bill might answer this too because he's seen it, but they're all at the same 1,000 acres, but they really didn't combine them. So there's a separate fire. There's a completely separate corrections. There's a completely separate law enforcement. It just happens that they're on the same campus. What we did in Oregon's, we said, it seems like they could use the same classrooms. It seems like they could use, you know, the same gyms and multipurpose rooms and those kinds of things. So everything's combined. And that's how we were able to get it onto 213 acres. As you can see, our bed capacity, it's planned for 500, the same as Georgia, but we're only doing 350 in this first phase. The projected facility sites is about the same. It's 300,000 square feet, but yet our cost ends up being $77 million versus their $145. I just want to assure you that I really think that the folks that worked on this have done an incredible job compressing and looking for efficiencies and looking for building efficiencies to make this a project that Oregon can be proud of in a sustainability sense and proud of in an efficiency sense. It is not... it is in no way a Taj Mahal. It is in no way. I mean, when this finally gets built, you will see that some of it is tilt up, some of it's metal, some of it's. I mean, we looked at each one to say, what does it really need to be? The other thing I think is kind of a comparison is the Washington State Patrol, which is just a single law enforcement agency. It doesn't do any of the other disciplines, is approximately the same size at 190 acres. I mean, and that's just what it took to get it done. And a big part of that, as you can imagine, is the emergency vehicle operation course. I think the other thing, as you think about this, and
I don't underestimate the difficulty of this decision for you in this economic time, but one of the things that I thought was a highlight, we don't have very many pluses these days, but one of them that we did have was when the COP sale occurred here recently, we had estimated what the costs would be for the $5 million sale, and it came in lower than our estimates. I mean, we had a rate of 3.89, I think, is where it came in. We won't see those very much longer, and I just think we need to think about that as we make a decision about something that is so critical to public safety, and it's not a matter of us not needing it. We needed it 8 years ago, and we need it even more desperately now, and I just think we need to weigh some of those factors in. I think also the LFO, Doug Wilson, has prepared for you a chart on how you might look at some of those costs. One of the questions that came up yesterday, and I really didn't have the answer with me, I just couldn't put my hands on it, was about some of the economic impacts as we move forward and we look at those different factors. And I do have a chart here for you that walks. What we did is we went through last night and made the ABC and D1 and 2 and E match up with LFO's chart so you could make the comparisons. And what this will show you is the economic benefit depending on which scenario you look at in terms of the timing of the COPs in the future and where you can have the greatest impact on the economy depending on the timing of when construction can begin. We could have a lot more discussion on that now or later, whenever you would like. But I think that will give you a little bit of insight on how we've been trying to make the decisions, how we've been working, weighing the economic impact for paying for the debt service against the life and safety issues for not doing it and the further delays, and then also looking at the positive nature in terms of what we could do for local economy. As you turn to page 43, there's just a very short list of deficiencies and things that we're not able to do at this point in time. I went over a number of those yesterday during the introductory remarks. I think one of the things that we probably don't think about because we think of some of the, I guess, the more skills-oriented parts of training, and we forget how important the cultural awareness and diversity aspect is. You've heard myself and also Marla Ray yesterday talk about the review of the agency back in 97. And on page 43, you'll notice in there that we basically do only a half day of training on cultural awareness. That's not very much. And we're going to try to get to 2 days. In that report, the recommendation was that we do 5 days. But we can't find that much time in even the 16 weeks to get to that level. It is a very important feature because officers do need to understand how to work with all kinds of people, with all kinds of issues, with all kinds of language barriers and cultural barriers. One of the things we've done to compensate for that is when we have developed scenarios, we try to ingrain that as an element of the scenario so that more and more time they have to think about it and come up with better ideas on how to deal with that. I think that gets us through most of the construction. We can go into that in more detail if you would like, if there are particular questions. If not, and we're ready to go forward, I would have Elaine Sears, our business manager, come up and kind of talk us through some of the answers to the questions that we have from yesterday.
Senator George.
Yeah, I just counted up. This is the criminal justice section on page 17. We have the interagency and intergovernment programs and all the participants here. And I see a large amount of resources that are available. And then I go over and I look at $77.8 million for a really nice facility that might be really nice sometime in the future. But as I'm going to tell you, as a business person, I would never make a decision to eliminate the very basic programs at the same time I was going to go spend $77.8 million when I had resources available, like we're seeing here with facilities and everything else. And I'm having heartburn with a couple of them. It isn't just yours, but I have one before my committee in which an agency brought me a brand new building, and their basic core service was not being completely addressed. And so how would you explain that to me? One other thing, and this is a statement based upon what we heard 3 weeks ago in Full Ways and Means, and that is the experts told us that day that we could expect most of these capital improvement type programs to not have really the impact into the economy until about the time we're in the middle of recovery. In other words, there was no bang now. And so I hope everyone's thinking.
There was an economic lag.
There was an economic lag to the. In other words, when you get the bang for your buck, it was when you didn't need that bang. So help me understand this. So with 27 supporter, you know, from the cities, all the rest of Montana, the Health Science University. I was thinking about facilities that are empty so much of the time, whether it's a school campus or something like that, where training can occur all over the state, weekends and this sort of thing. Why we would want to spend $78 million?
Kirkpatrick and Senator George, it's an excellent question. If you look down through that, what you will see is many of those are the current facilities that we have pieced together to try and get to 10 weeks.
Right.
And the problem is they, if you take the first one, for example, the Camp Adair firing range, there, I guess the second one, there's nothing we can do with that to have it allow us to do like subdued firing or nighttime firing or any of those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter what we do, we can't get there. Even though that does a piece of it, it doesn't get the full training.
But Diane, for example, let me interrupt you for a second if I could, Mr. Chair. We do nighttime firing at the Dundee, let's see, Crabtree Park, which is a firing range. They do nighttime training there at all the time.
Chair Patrick, Senator George, we're flat out not allowed to do it there. Yeah. I want to say 3 or 4 years ago, there was a huge hue and cry from the neighbors because of the amount of firing that was going on. And part of the agreement to be able to continue to even use the range was that we agreed to not be firing at night. And so we have that restriction placed against us.
Well, let me share with you. When we were looking for a prison siting other than in the middle of Wilsonville, I found several pieces of property that are owned by ODOT that are old quarry sites that are, I mean, these are great big gigantic pits in the middle of nowhere. And I was just wondering, what have we explored doing that sort of thing? Because my thought is that you have so many opportunities within our inventory of facilities and before we go spend the $78 million.
Chair Patridge and Senator George, we did explore that, and in fact, one of the original places we looked at had a quarry not that far. However, the environmental issues are such now that you actually cannot site ranges because of the need for lead cleanup and those kinds of things, that it was prohibitive. And if my memory serves me, the national standard now that's set for siting a range is like you have to have a 5-mile clearance radius to site a new range of any kind. I mean, you couldn't do it. And that was part of the reason, even as we started trying to find a site, we initially thought that we would do an outdoor range, and we found that you just couldn't do that anymore in this day and age, was to site one for the amount of use that we were going to do for all the various environmental reasons. So that's the reason we went to the indoor ranges and then had to figure out how we would get them to do all the things we needed them to do. And cost-wise, it ended up that was a smarter choice for us to make.
All right. Representative Hansen had a quick question.
Well, not a question, just a comment. My good senator colleague. You're probably right in terms of the economic impact. Sometimes on a project like this comes after you need it. But we didn't have the foresight to do it 2 years ago. So it's not a case of either not needing it or not needing the impact. It's just that there's no real way to gauge when the recovery will start. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of good guessing in terms of when that's going to happen. Current circumstances, a $77 million construction job that would contribute $4.8 million to the general fund is probably something that in this biennium we're going to need, especially while we're budgeting for the general fund now.
I want to allow enough time to get everything in, so I'm wondering if you could just, we have the sign-up sheet. I don't want to start that yet. I wondered how many people are going to want to testify. One, two, three, four.
Okay.
What I'd like to do is I'd like to leave 30 minutes for public testimony and questions on public testimony. So we'll start that in about 10 minutes, but if people can sign up so we can start you there. I'd like to go over the questions, Diane, that were raised yesterday. I'd also like Doug to pass out because I am going to ask Fire Chief, the Sheriff, some of these other people. I asked DPSST to prepare, and Diane had prepared this particular piece. One of the things that I wrote on the priority list was looking at cost shifts back to local government in terms of the training. Diane can explain this to some degree, but I think generally it tells us what it would be if we cost shifted back to local government, the basic training in each of these areas. As I told the committee, it's not somewhere where I want to go, but I did want to make that available to the committee because we're going to be facing some very dire and difficult circumstances in the upcoming biennia. I have to step out for a moment, so I'm going to turn the chair over to Representative Butler. But if we can do that, I think we can.
Okay.
We can get out of here.
So 30 minutes, Mr. Chair. I'm going to capitalize on the concerns that Senator George did mention. That I too share those concerns, and I would like to know that of the other 45 states that are in the same dire straits and difficulty, that in fact they have maintained 22-week programs of training, professional training. Because I can't hardly believe that those folks are, I know that they're probably not out building multimillion-dollar facilities like this, but my angst is that in addition to not building the facilities, I don't know where they're getting their funds to continue to have 22-week average long programs. And, of course, we talk about 22 weeks average. Some of them must have 30-week programs, and others, you know, I mean, when you throw in Oregon's programs. So I just share Senator George's angst over all of the resources we're talking about for the training, and would like to have some sense of the fact that they are, in fact, other states are not making other alternative arrangements while they're in financial difficulties as well. Because while we're trying to ramp up what other states used to do, we might find ourselves in bigger and hotter water still. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Butler, and I should be back here in a minute.
Good strategy. Pass out the thing on local shift.
Run out the door.
Yeah.
No, I'll be back. I'm willing to take the heat.
Okay. Doug, who's this? Is this Diane's?
Actually, this is the chair's.
This is the chair's.
I think the agency was going to spend a few minutes going through some specific questions from yesterday at the end of the meeting.
Okay, as we're approaching that time.
And then about 2:30, I think we need to take the
right
testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Doug.
Representative Butler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elaine Sears. I'm the business manager for DPSST. One of the questions yesterday had to do with the changes in our government service charges, and I am providing you with a document that is two-sided. One side has the government service charges. We could start with that. I've listed for you what the total charges were in 01-03, what the new charge is for 03-05, giving you the difference and the percent of the increase or, in some cases, decrease. I'm sure you know that these charges come from the state price list, and we balance to that. So these charges are what the assessments are for the agency as we went into agency request and governor's balanced budget. The major changes for us had to do with the DAS IRMD assessments that equaled about 48.25% of the total increase for our agency. And the other significant change was in the risk management division assessments, and the tort liability just increased statewide for that assessment. So hopefully that'll answer your question about the government service charges.
What is MWESB? I'm sorry, I don't know all the acronyms.
Representative Butler, that means minority women, emerging small business.
They assess your agency.
That's our share of the assessment.
Okay.
On the other side of that document, there were specific changes yesterday about changes to our services and supplies categories. And again, when we go into building the budget, agencies are given some leeway to rebalance expenditure limitation within specific S&S accounts. I've been with the agency a relatively short time, but we have an accounting supervisor who's a certified public accountant, and with my accounting background, we've made an effort to realign the expenditure limitation to more closely resemble our current expenditures and the anticipated trends. So most of the adjustments were made according to that methodology. What you don't see is the base budget, and we're instructed to balance bottom line services and supplies to the previous biennium, so our base budget balanced across the line. Then when we came into the governor's balanced budget, we had other reductions, so you'll see additional changes there. I've tried to summarize that for you, and in the comments column, given you a little further explanation. If you have any specific questions regarding that.
Publications is down by 428,000.
Well, previously when the agency built the budget, they included many items in there that were truly office expenses. They considered a lot of the copying charges to be publications, and so in order to correct the coding on those expenditures, we have a very complicated accounting crosswalk that matches the budget account structures. So most of that is just clearing up those coding.
So the 428 is offset in part by the 300,000 under 4650, which is other services and supplies, and an increase of 297,000.
That would be correct.
Of office supplies.
We rebalance overall to in the base budget to equal the legislatively adopted budget from the previous biennium.
Okay, are there questions regarding the handout of Ms. Sears? Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Butler, members of the committee, another question had to do with the change in our temporary appointments and overtime payments. Again, I've given you more detail than you want, and in order to keep this brief, I will tell you that those are considered non-PICS generated accounts. Agencies are not allowed anything beyond standard inflation for the most part unless it's approved in a package. The package 010 that you see on there, that is the standard inflation, and then the mass transit tax adjustment, which has a different calculation. The only other increase had to do with package 106, which was the increase in our telecommunications EMD training, and that was included in the governor's balanced budget. So that accounts for the changes to those non-fixed accounts.
Are there questions regarding the second handout dealing with the cost of temporary appointments, budget account 3160. Thank you, Ms. Sears. Next.
And I think we're just about up against the wall, as I see Elko nodding his head. What we will do is we had some additional questions. It takes a little bit more time to get them in a comprehensive form for you, but we will finish them and get them to you, submit them to the committee in writing, if that will work. I do also have the chair of our board had hoped to be here today, but at the last minute was unable to. He did prepare some written testimony, which I would just submit on his behalf, if that would be okay.
Fine. Thank you very much, Diane. Then we will, yes, I beg your pardon. The chair recognizes Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to make another burden on the department, but there is something I'd be interested in seeing. And you've given the average number of students that you have in each program on an annual basis. Can you just provide the committee, if you do anything that's similar to like an annual schedule so we could see what the scheduling was in terms of these classes, because you have people coming in for 10 weeks, people coming in for 4 weeks. You know,
it's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
So what's your beat?
We'll start with Brian DeLashman. Brian?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLashman. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Federation of Drug and Parole and Probation Officers, and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I just have a couple of observations, and actually, in a couple of cases, some responses to part of the presentation that have been made over the last two days. My first two comments are primarily around the issue of the 10 weeks versus 16 weeks. In representing police officer, line officers, and corrections officers in this state, along with parole and probation officers, one of the things that I hear more often than not when the issue of the board comes up is the 10 weeks versus 16 weeks. They are very concerned about where we're at now, that we've been there for a long time and we haven't moved to 16 weeks. It doesn't appear like we're going to get there very quickly because of budget constraints. Many of these officers just simply do not believe that the current training meets their needs, and they are primarily concerned not only about, obviously, their ability to do their function in their jobs for the safety of the public, but they are very concerned about their own safety with the way the situation currently existed. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. This has been an issue since I've represented them over the last 4 or 5, 6 years. I hear it repeatedly. And it seems, after hearing this presentation, that we're not getting there. The second observation I have, and some of you may have heard this before in other committees, is a lack of ability or buy-in by the line officers in this this state into both the board and the department. I guess I would characterize that in one of two ways. Currently, there are 23 positions on the board. Of those, and somebody can correct me, but I believe there's only 5 or 6 that include line officers, whether it's a police officer, firefighter, or a corrections officer. And I would submit to you that who in this state knows better about what their individual needs were when they're working in their position, whether it's a correction officer or a line officer, police officer in the streets, as to what their needs are. And when it comes to both the training process and the revocations and suspensions, I would submit to you that a review by 23 members, in which only 5 are line staff, is not, in fact, a jury of their peers. So we are working in at least one other committee in this building, actually two committees, one in the Senate and one in the House, in the possibility of a revision of what we feel is a too large board to a smaller board that's more representative of all the needs in this state and functions in a probably a much more efficient way. 23 members, as you know, is very unwieldy. The next thing that I would mention is rules process, and it's actually related to the issue that I just talked about of representation on the board. There is a series of rules that come from this department and this board that I see these little email firestorms with police officers and firefighters in which they're not listening to us again. And again, I think part of it has to do with the buy-in to the process. But I also get a very strong sense that in many cases, the lack of input or the ability to have input from the line officers maybe creates part of these problems. One such example that I'm seeing right now is a rules that they're going to look at April 17th in front of the whole board, dealing with individual officers being required to keep their in essence continuing education up to date for their certification. And the issue there obviously is some officers, one, either don't have the ability to get away, can't get the time to get away, their department doesn't allow them to get away, there is no other way to get the update, a whole variety of issues. And so there's a lot of concern right now about not only the initial training, but how do they in fact keep up to date, and if they don't keep up to date, obviously they can lose their certification. I'm not totally versed in that. I leave that up to the attorneys for the association, but I do know there's a major issue there, and I think a lot of that's related to the issue or the ability for these line officers to have interaction with the board, feel that there's representation on the board, and play a part in that. The last thing that I will mention is the Public Safety Memorial Fund. The deputy director mentioned one bill in particular, the bill that they had introduced that dealt with lump sum. And I don't have the number. It's either 2341 or 2338 or 2438, in which he indicated that there was a work group working to try and both make the Public Safety Memorial Fund more efficient, cost efficient, but also short and long term, to make sure that we're not overlapping with other programs to make sure that people are not getting more benefits than they need, but in fact are staying with what we believe is the promise that the state made when Senator or Representative Westland, I promoted him, first brought up that idea, and it was passed in 99. I'll let you know that we have met. There are several suggestions. I will mention one of them that I think is a good suggestion, and we will be supporting it, is in the area of college education. There are a number of programs in the state. The higher education system has a scholarship for fallen officers' children. The federal government now has one, as does the state under this program. We are looking at making the Memorial Fund actually the second on the list of applications. That you first make application to the federal program. If for some reason you don't meet the criteria there and are disqualified there, that you have the ability to step down to the state program. And if you meet the standards or the qualifications there, they would meet that need. Instead of the hodgepodge we have now, we would obviously like to maximize the dollars that the feds are putting out, minimize the expense to the state. I think that actually discussion is going very well. With that, I'll end my comments. I hope I didn't just kind of spill things out, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions both at this hearing and subsequent. I know you have a limited amount of time, but my clients do have a number of concerns about this department and this board.
Thank you very much, Brian. Doug, I noticed you were looking in the statutes, the Oregon Revised Statutes. Does it provide for some direction relative to the makeup of the board?
It is quite prescriptive, Mr. Chair. In fact, I think all 23 members are listed separately and representing, you know, fire chiefs, police chiefs, plus X number of people from various, or, you know, patrol or police officers, a fire person, telecommunications person. So it is very prescriptive, and to do that, you'd have to have a change in the law.
Okay. And does it, by any chance, call on a jury by the peers? Brian indicated that this was a jury by the peers. I hope that they don't stand as a jury at any point, that they are merely recommending on behalf of all of the continuing education needs of the various professions.
Mr. Chair, that comment was related to discipline revocation. This body
see.
Has the ability to review somebody's certification and revoke it, and this is very unlike any other board I'm familiar with. Whether it's the Board of Nursing, Board of Medical Examiners, or any other board, this board is so large and so totally dominated by non-line officers that, in fact, it's not representative of the workforce out there.
But it is not to be a jury of their peers when they're tried. So it's indicated of the whole board, indicating the whole board would pass on any of that kind of sanctioning.
Again, Mr. Chair, my comment was in line with the ability to revoke or suspend somebody's
right,
certification.
Thank you. Further questions of Mr. Leisman? Senator George is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to philosophical again. We have a couple bills floating around. One of them will require a police officer or anyone with a weapon to properly secure it in their home, a gun safe, that sort of thing. As far as I can tell, the bulk of those ideas are including the officer standing for that cost. And my question is, with the cuts that are being talked about here to the actual training program, do you think the line officer or the fire department workers are willing to, you know, pay into a process in order to maintain the training?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think it depends on what the obviously the fee is and what they feel they're getting as far as value for that. I do know, I'm not understanding the relationship between lockboxes for safe storage and guns to this particular department.
In other words, we're asking an employee to pay for certain things that we have mandated, and now I'm asking you if, in fact, I don't know if anybody has resisted that and said, well, maybe that's something the agency ought to pay for. But what I'm saying to you is that, in fact, rather than have an attorney system go away, I would want to participate in paying for it if I were one of those officers.
Mr. Chair, Senator George. I'm going
to get an email soon.
Yeah, we're interested in a dialogue, again, for value and what it is. Obviously, the officers are concerned about safety, their own safety, and the safety of the public. And if we can have a discussion about those issues and relationship to the budget, we're more than happy to do that. I guess I would take one step back, though, and say that in some jurisdictions in the state, the jurisdiction doesn't even supply the weapon. In order to be a police officer, the officer has to supply their own weapon. So it goes in even beyond the safety and the training and the DPSSD itself. We're talking about some basic equipment.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Hansen is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question that came up earlier related to the scheduling of classes and getting the most efficient usage of facilities and how it applies to the issue of overtime pay for trainees. Is that something that would cause a lot of heartburn during labor negotiations, or is it something that might have a chance of being coordinated?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, at the risk of because I'm not the labor rep for any of these folks, I'm the legislative person stepping outside of my bounds. Again, I think we're willing to have some discussions about how to most efficiently use the facilities we have now in timely fashion. However, with that said, I think obviously we would have to have some very significant internal discussions if, in fact, somebody was working 60, 70, 80-hour weeks, including their training, and they were on straight time. I think that's a discussion we could have, but it's not a discussion that I guess I'm first enough as to what's been happening now and what potentially could happen in the future.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Let's see. Stan Gibson. I overlooked the fact that Stan had come from over 100 miles away, so welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stan Gibson. I'm currently serving as the fire chief in Coos Bay, Oregon, and I've been there for almost 7 years. In addition to being a fire chief, I also serve as an adjunct instructor for the National Fire Academy in Emmitsburg, Maryland, and in their regional delivery program. Also, I serve on the committee of International Fire Service Training Association, where we write the curriculum and the manuals that firefighters use. I guess my first comments today would be directed towards the Memorial Fund, since our community is using that quite extensively right now. And we have 11 children that will be looking at this Memorial Fund in the future for higher education. And I would just ask you to take into consideration those 11 kids before we change anything very dramatically on educational. The scholarships that are available for firefighters on a national level, there are 8 that are available nationwide through the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. And that is an extremely competitive process. So we're not real sure how successful our kids are going to be on getting a federal scholarship that was mentioned. We're certainly going to apply for all of them, but we're not, again, at 100 firefighters annually that die in the line of duty. This brings a lot of competitiveness to that program. The overall activity of the program with the liability that I heard about here today of $10 million versus $1 million, my only comment to that is that I really wish we could have done more for these families. In the initial phases or the initial days after our incident, the families were devastated, as you can well imagine, and in need of financial support as well as emotional and spiritual support. And it was through the Memorial Fund that we were able, within a matter of weeks, to present these folks with checks and to eliminate some of their financial concerns that they had as soon as they got their feet about them and started thinking, now what am I going to do? I need to go on. So that Memorial Fund played an extremely important role in filling that gap. Yes, there's a number of other benefits out there that these folks will be available to them and be eligible for, but some of those take a period of time before they come through. The $262,000 that was mentioned from the Public Safety Officer Death Benefit Fund from the Department of Justice, that money is just hasn't even started to arrive yet. We have those requests in, and as you can imagine, they're being looked at by folks in Washington, D.C. We're hoping to hear from them any time, but it's been almost 5 months since our incident. And if that was the only thing the families had, these bills would be tallying up on them quite a bit. So I urge you to look at that and think of these our families and what the fund did, what the intent of the fund was, and how much support it provided to them at that time. And I also want you to know that as a department, we really appreciated that because it was very beneficial. It was very healing for us to be able to bring in those people and give them those checks and say, here, let us help you at this time also.
Senator George?
Stan, I have a reputation in this building of getting angry quick and getting over it quick, but this is one I'm angry about and I'm not getting over.
Okay.
If you know where I'm coming from. I'm so mad about this. When I first heard it, I couldn't believe the governor did it. And I hope that we're able to do something about replenishing this fund because it's just so offensive. And it isn't the fact that I have a son-in-law who was a police officer. I felt this way before, and I would feel this way no matter what happened, you know, to my daughter and her family. But the main thing is it just is so basic that, I mean, it was one of the questions I started to ask relative to spending $78 million for a new facility. What kind of priority is this when we're saying to the people whose family members have lost their lives in service that, by the way, yours is gone, but we can go build a brand new building? So anyway, I appreciate what you had to say.
I appreciate your comments, Senator. That's very much the way that I think all of us feel also about it.
I did have one question, Stan,
yes.
Relative to the Public Safety Officer Benefit, that's PSOB, that $262,100 to eligible beneficiaries, that's a federal payment?
Yes, that is a federal payment.
And you say it takes some time for that to come back?
Yes, it's quite a challenge to fill out the paperwork.
Okay. And that's payable as a lump sum to the
That is
survivor.
Payable as a lump sum and that the beneficiaries are established by federal statute on
okay.
where the money goes.
Available to the spouse and children?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And I know that Diane's going to have a test for me on this afterwards, but I wanted to start getting some of that down so that I could figure out where this is going to come out. But please proceed, Stan. Thank
yes.
You.
Thank you. In relationship to the fire training, 80% of your firefighters in the state of Oregon are volunteers out of approximately 10,000 firefighters. These 80% rely on DPSST to provide this training through the regional concept. And most of these folks are, if they're paying money at all, it's coming out of their own pocket. The volunteer fire service is a tremendous benefit to the citizens that it serves. And so anything that would create a problem for those folks, I think, certainly needs to be looked at. As a chief of a department that is a municipal department, when we talk about cost sharing, we feel like we're already doing that because many times our instructors are certified by DPSST. They act as instructors for not only our organization but neighboring organizations. And as a trainer, instructor training becomes extremely important, making sure that these folks are trained properly on how to present the material that needs to be presented. As you can well imagine, the number of investigations that are going on currently in relationship to our incident on November 25th, many of the issues are coming back to the training of the individuals that were involved, not only the firefighters who lost their lives, but also the command officers who were on the scene and company officers who were on the scene. And so the DPSST training becomes extremely important to limit the liability of our organization, to prove that we were doing the right things and we knew what to do correctly.
Those standards come from DPSST based on the curriculum that is written and adopted by them and by their board. In addition to that, that comes from national standards from the National Fire Protection Association. One of the things that is being looked at now that was really a surprise to us is that as we are being looked at by other regulatory agencies in the state as to our actions, that they are using NFPA standards as a basis of our training. And so without DPSST developing the curriculum based on those national standards, what would a small organization use as their training criteria? And so it's extremely important that that criteria and instructor training be continued. You also asked about cost sharing as far as would we be willing to share some. Our organization is 50 people, of which 16 of us are career and 34 are volunteers. We have a current training budget of approximately $10,000. That sounds like a lot of money until you realize that we're training 50 folks with that 12 months a year and trying to meet mandatory training, annual training requirements. We do need help on specialized training, such as props and instructors. Some of the areas would include hazardous materials, confined space rescue, and rope rescue, where the local fire department may be the only person in that area that is providing that service. That concludes my notes.
Thank you very much, Chief Gibson. Other questions for Chief Gibson? We appreciate you being here. Thank you very much.
Let me go. I did forget one thing. I do want to comment about the facility mm-hmm. and the need for a facility. Prior to coming to Oregon, I was in another state where I served as the state director of fire training, and we had dueling facilities between fire and police, and it really was very ineffective and inefficient as to shared cost. Many times those two disciplines will not necessarily agree 100% of the time. So the multidiscipline of this facility is something that is a key for its success. And I think that the facility is needed. These specialty programs that we talk about that cannot be trained in Coos Bay, but we need to go to a central point with other professionals from around the state, certainly benefits the training environment.
Thank you very much. Let's see. Dave Burright, Sheriff, Linn County.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dave Burright. I'm the Linn County Sheriff, here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association in my office. Now, I am fortunate enough, I think, to come from a fairly large law enforcement family. In fact, started with my dad. He started in Corvallis, at the Corvallis PD in the late 40s. And I've always loved, he's 76 now, still alive. I have a great time talking with him about the old days, especially his first days at Corvallis. And, you know, he talks about those days, and, of course, there weren't any portable radios at all. And in fact, there was a light strung over Main Street in Corvallis, and when the officers were out on patrol and they needed them to come in to take a report or a call, they flip a switch at the PD and that would turn on the red light, and the officers knew they needed to come in. You know, he talks about there are very few reports that they ever had to do back in those days. You know, he said there's some major crime going on, but really a busy Friday night was dealing with hormonal raging frat members who were conducting a panty raid on one of the sororities there at the university. That was a busy night. You can't remember DUIs being any big deal back in the early days. This is the late 40s. He'd never heard of domestic violence back in those days. He never heard of marijuana, let alone methamphetamine. Miranda was still years away when he started as a police officer. They were progressive in some ways, though. They'd occasionally get a bicycle out of evidence. It was just abandoned property, and they patrol on bicycle. That was kind of a neat thing to do. Of course, they could do the whole town on a bike. It wasn't that big a deal. The jail was a two-holer It was actually recycled from a battleship, is what I'm told. It was flat bar stock steel lattice like that, and I remember it well as a kid. I used to get thrown in it all the time just for fun. I don't know about the county jail in Benton County at the time. I do know about the Linn County Jail back then because the sheriff lived in a little apartment right in the jail with his wife, and part of her duties were to cook meals for the inmates whenever there were any inmates in there. And oftentimes there were no inmates in the county jail. Thank God I wouldn't be the sheriff if that was still a requirement today. No, suing a police officer or a governmental agency was unheard of, was unthinkable in those days. No one, it just didn't happen. And there was also no basic police academy when Dad started. I started in this business in 1976. As I said, one of many of us in the family. And at, you know, at that point, Oregon was really growing up. And when I started at Linn County, we had, as I recall, about 75 total staff at the Linn County Sheriff's Office. And we were pretty busy. But I can remember many times working graveyard by myself out on patrol, the only police officer on duty in the county for 2,300 square miles. And that's just the way we did business. We were just getting portable radios in Linn County when I was starting there. We didn't have any computers at the time, but there were computers around. And my father-in-law was a systems analyst for Oregon State, and he worked on an IBM computer that was literally, I think, bigger than this room. It had this throwaway freebie pocket calculator is more powerful than the computer that my father-in-law worked on at that time. We had marijuana, and that was a really big deal back then, but we had no meth in place in 76. The jail was always full, in fact, full to bursting. It was an old standard steel design on top of the courthouse, and the sheriff had long since moved out of there. We were starting to see lawsuits, especially in the field of corrections, and those were beginning to be more and more of a concern to us. And my basic academy, when I went winter of 1977, was 8 weeks. There were no mandates about what they had to teach, as I recall, minimal, if any, corrections training for those in the jail. But we'd gone in roughly 25 years, from no training to 8 weeks of training, but the world was growing. And today, 2003, I'm very proud and honored to be the Linn County Sheriff, and I have been for a little over 8 years. But in the 26, almost 27 years since I've been with the office, the county and the state has continued to grow and grow up. Right now, at least for the moment, I've got just a little over 200 staff in a jail of 230 beds. I've got multiple deputies working every single shift, and they run ragged from call to call. I've got multiple disciplines within my office. Of course, police officers, corrections, parole and probation is a division of my office, as well as I run, I wish Representative Patrick were here, I run the one and only 911 call center in the county. So I have telecommunicators on my staff. We are totally emerged in the age of technology. Computers run everything. They run the CAD, computer-aided dispatch. They run everything to deal with the jail, our crimes package, dealing with patrol and all the report systems and everything goes with those. Parole and probation is hooked to the state computer system and sharing information all over the state. Everything, and this is the technology age. Forensics is a major tool that we use all the time, and it's expected by the public. Just watch CSI in Miami, and all, in 60 minutes they can solve the world's problems. I am served, probably in the average, one or two notices of tort claim a month, at least, at the office. And the first thing that these folks want when they serve the notice and the suit gets filed is obviously they want the report on the incident, and then they want the officer's personnel file and his training record. Always want his training record. Methamphetamine is involved in the majority of our crimes and involves a tremendous amount of cleanup and cost and expertise to handle. Our lab safety officers are scientists in and of themselves. Compared to the day when Dad started, or even when I started, our officers are really required to be attorneys in many regards. not only civilly, but constitutionally, you know what those issues are. They have to I never had to prosecute my own cases, ever. But many of my deputies now, on a routine basis, prosecute their own cases in court. They have to be a scientist, and probably most of all, a counselor. The people that we're dealing with on the street, the criminals, are extraordinarily well armed. Things that we never would have dreamed of when I started. Not only fully automatic weapons, but gas masks and the electronics that they have. We've been, in the last few years, chasing a burglary ring that has a far better radio system than I ever dreamed of. And today, with all that going on, our academy is only 10 weeks. And along with that, the mandates abound. Just look in the statute, and DPST shall, you just look. They're there. And I know in tracking the bills that are before this session, there are a number of other bills that DPST shall. And all those things apply to 10 weeks. I find it incredible. I just learned that a hairdresser has to train for 36 weeks. And something's wrong with this picture. I mean, I know turning your wife's hair green is important and a bad thing, but 36 weeks versus 10 for police officers. So obviously my message is that training is seriously lagging. And I'm not suggesting that there's a direct parallel between the years that I've talked about, the little over 50 years, and the number of weeks training. But we have seen a massive change to our world in those 50 years, and we've got to do something about it. There's been talk about how do we pay for everything, and Senator George, I've been very involved with the state budget and my other duties with the Oregon State Sheriff Association. I understand that. But I also believe that a basic function of government is to provide for the safety of its citizens. And I think you all are in a real bind. You have unfunded mandates too. Measure 5 has put you in a horrible position, I think, with funding of the schools and everything that's gone with that. But I think that, well, enough said. Every state that I'm aware of has some type of police officer standards and training. And everyone that I know has minimum standards and certification that helps guide what goes on in their state. And I think this is critical to us and to maintain a strong DPSST present, because I think it's critical to provide consistent, uniform training among all the police agencies in the state. Representative Patridge, when he was a prosecutor, I think had at least a basic expectation that when this police agency investigated a crime, they had the basics to get it done, just like this one did. And when they were forced to work together, you know, like what happens every day, I call Portland, or my deputies do, or Medford, or wherever, we know that they have the basic capabilities to go out and handle whatever it is that we need done. Cricks don't follow political lines, and so we need to make sure their training is also uniform and consistent. I'd also state strongly we can't stop at the basic training, because the world does continue to change, and many of the skills that we teach our young men and women diminish without practice. Now, a lot of larger agencies, I think, have the capability to provide that in-house. I think probably those that have it are doing it. I would probably fit into a medium-sized agency. And I can tell you that already, with everything that's happening with the state government, there's a ripple effect down. At the moment, I have over 200 staff. We've been in the middle of our budget hearings. I'm getting ready to close 48 beds, it looks like, in the jail. This coming year, because of what appear to be cuts from the state, and I don't yet know how many staff that I'm going to lose.
Dave, you've also put us on notice from the state that you may withdraw.
Thank you.
And turn over 1145 to the state. So
that's right.
You know, Dave in the local jurisdictions.
Yes, that's right.
An interesting situation.
I guess what I would like to stress is that, well, in fact, it's a little sobering. Most of the men and women that I'm hiring now to be police officers and corrections officers and telecommunicators and weren't born yet when all of us started in our adult careers. That is a very sobering thought to me. On the other hand, these are the same...
Except for the chair.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm not so sure about that. We'll leave that alone. I find that these people, though...
are extremely intelligent, they're very sharp. We just need to give them the tools and the training that they need to have to carry out their function. And we are falling behind. You already know the stats about other states. As far as I know, Washington is 16 weeks going on 18. California averages 24 and a half is my information. You know, even the states in the deep south and southeast, those that have a history of a horrible law enforcement reputation, have training that is above Oregon's now. And Oregon is developing a reputation. Not yet, I don't think, in the law enforcement realm, but because of all the struggles that we're having economically right now, we do have a reputation nationwide as struggling. Ask your economic development folks that are out beating on the doors. And what I don't want to have happen, is to have Oregon become the southeast or the northwest. And that's really my concern. We are facing tough, tough decisions, but we need to keep DPSSD strong, and we need to increase the basic training.
Thank you, Sheriff. Other questions for the Sheriff?
May I wade in with your indulgence on one other thing?
Hey, Dave.
In regards to the Memorial Fund, I am personally totally conflicted, have a conflict on this issue, and I'll tell you that right up front. And I have not followed what changes are being proposed to the Memorial Fund, but I would ask that you look at them very carefully before you deal and monkey with the intent and the purpose for which that was created. About 5 o'clock on September 4th, 2001, I'd gotten home a little early from work, and I called my brother. And he was at home, and we chatted like two brothers do, and he had been out playing ball with his three boys, but he couldn't talk with me very long because he had to hurry up and get showered and get to work. He was a sergeant with Oregon State Police. And about 7 o'clock that night, I got a call from my shift supervisor at work, telling me that he didn't know any details yet, but from calls coming into our 911 center and from monitoring radio traffic, it appeared the Oregon State Police were involved in a bad crash south of Salem, and that they had at least one trooper down, and it appeared that there were fatalities. And didn't know names, but I knew that exact moment that John was one of the people involved, because that's the kind of sergeant he was. He was hands-on with his troops out on the street, and that's the area he liked to work. And I paced around the house, and I don't know, it was about 6:30 or so when the local station commander called me and said, if you heard what's going on. And I said, I know you've got a bad situation, but I don't know the details. And he says, it's John. And at that point, they didn't think there were any survivors. He says, they thought they had three down and killed. And so we knew my sister-in-law was at the high school. That evening, there was a parent club meeting of some kind going on, and so my wife and I prepared to meet Andy Olson as the station commander and his wife, and we went to the high school to tell my sister-in-law. And as we had an aide running down to the room where this group was to pull her out so that I could tell her that John was dead, Andy's been on the cell phone, and he starts hollering. He says, wait, he says, somebody's still alive. He says, we don't know who, we don't know what's going on, but somebody's still alive. They're calling for life flight. And so as it turned out, an Albany Police Department officer who was riding with my brother was killed instantly. Maria was killed instantly. Another Oregon State Police trooper, and John was horribly critically injured. And that is a little over a year and a half ago. Every morning I go and see him, and I tell him good morning, and told him about my day, told him this morning that, you know, I'm going to be working on the office in the morning and I had to come up here this afternoon. But I promised him I'd be back tonight, and every night I go back and I spend an hour, hour and a half with him just talking, as does the rest of my family throughout the day. And
I just tell you that because that memorial fund does make a difference. Those, my three nephews are 8, 12, and 15. They're going to be dependent, I would greatly suspect, on this. I'm happy that we don't have to worry about their college. I don't even know the financial details, but Rhonda, my sister-in-law, has been helped by the fund, and I just ask you to be very careful when we look at changing it, because it does make a difference. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. We appreciate it. Thanks for sharing your personal story with us.
I'm sorry. Are there any questions, sir?
Thank you. We have Mary left.
I don't want to go after that.
No. Sorry. We're getting it done.
Okay.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Bodkin with AFSCME Council 75, and we actually represent the folks who work at DPSST and provide a lot of the training there. I'm going to be very, very brief because I know time is of the essence right now. Two things I want to say. In 1989, our union was successful in working with this legislature to get the Department of Corrections officers into the DPSST training program for certified training statewide. Up until that point, corrections officers had no certified training. There was no consistency, no training materials at all. And it showed in the level of professionalism that they had. And I think that now we have one of the finest teams of professional corrections officers in the country. And largely that is due to the training that's provided through DPSST. The following session, we were so thrilled with ourselves that we came back and put 911 in as well. Because we felt the same thing about 911, that there should be consistent training, and we saw that as the communication industry was kind of exploding, that those skills were going to be, that uniform training was going to be needed, and that every 911 operator in every corner of the state ought to have the same skills that a 911 operator had in the metropolitan areas of the state. And again, we think it's a very good thing, and we think that that's very important. What we see happening, and Mr. Chair, I've been in front of this committee several times already, you know, and I've decided I'm not going to play one budget off against the other. I'm just going to testify for each budget. This is a bad budget, okay? They're all bad budgets. But I am concerned that we're asking the training staff to do more with less. And I share Sheriff Burright's concerns about the fact that the bad guys are ahead of us here. And I use guys in a totally euphemistic term, non-gender-based, because the next thing I want to say is I agree with Brian DeLashmet. The board is problematic. The revocation process is autocratic and out of touch. We've had two officers in our corrections units who have faced revocation. In both cases, the department did not support the revocation of either officer. However, one officer is still, I believe, still on appeal. And one officer resigned. It was very interesting because the officer who resigned was actually convicted as a teenager of shoplifting, thought her records had been expunged over the years, found out they had not been, and was terminated for lying on her application, and it was not brought forward by the department from everything that we could find out. It really concerns us that there's so little democracy in the process, that we would kind of throw away an officer who was trained and working. And I'm sorry that Representative Butler's not here, because it was in the institution in his district, and as he can tell you, it's not easy to fill those vacancies in Ontario, Oregon. Finally, I'm again, in the interest of time, I'm just going to say that we're also concerned about the balance of the board, not only the line staff to the supervisory staff, but also the gender balance. This is a profession that talks about opening its doors to look like the community, to attempting to make sure that we have a balanced approach to recruitment. And yet, for the Corrections Advisory Committee, there is one female on the board who is now retired. That is just absolutely unacceptable to us. You cannot recruit women in the workforce if you don't have women in the profession talking to them. And we just think that the board needs to have a very serious going over, if you will. We think it needs to be more balanced. We think it needs to reflect more of the demographics of the actual workforce that they're representing and of the communities in which they work. So having said that, I don't want to be overly critical of this agency. Diane Middle, it's my job to make her nervous when I get up here about not being sure whether I'm going to really get after him or not. But I do think that there's room for improvement. But I also think that we have to give credit where credit is due, and that is that they have brought a lot of professionalism into the whole law enforcement community, and that is very, very important. I just think that overall, for the limited resources we give them, they do a pretty good job. And I just think we ought to really take a look. Senator George has heard me say this before. New revenue. That would be good. We were the largest contributors to ballot measure 28. We're supporting them. You know, our union never saw a tax it didn't like. So, you know, we'll just continue to support all these little tax measures, regardless.
You swear that thing that she's under oath.
Senator George, you know it's true. Anyway, having said that,
the chair won't share with you what Senator Devlin, Representative Hansen, and staff overheard Senator George say.
He's actually said it to me as well. He has said it to me as well. He and I are actually on the same page on a couple of things, which probably ought to scare the devil out of both of us.
Mary.
Senator Devlin.
I just had a quick question.
In terms
of revocation, if you were going to change the process, and obviously you have to do it statutorily, and you were going to have what you think would be a fair system, wouldn't you have to develop systems that were for various different levels in the sense, I mean, I think Glassman talked about line staff, but my only recollection of a revocation that I know about is a small city police chief that was near my district that the board probably had good cause to revoke. So it would seem like you'd have to set up different layers if you were going to actually make it a more representative body that a person would appear before.
I think that there needs to be a very clear, Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I think there just needs to be a clearer appeals process and a clearer process. I don't think it's appropriate to have people who have no relationship with the institution or the department who is involved making the decision from two arm lengths away. You know, I actually believe that the superintendent of the institution ought to have some say. You know, and having said that, I also think that there are times when that, you know, I think I agree with you. Let me just cut to the chase. I think I agree with you. Because in saying that out loud, I realize I don't want a superintendent to have absolute authority either, because that then creates a whole different level of potential problems. But I do think we need a better process. And Senate Bill 210, 190, 290 whatever it was that created this, we can revoke your license if we don't like the way you comb your hair bill from last session, was just like way over the edge one way. We need to kind of crawl back a little bit and figure out if there's not a better way to do it.
I know that the policy committees are taking up the issue surrounding the board of DPSST. I don't know how you deal with a 23-member board, but apparently you do. I would be interested, for the sake of the Ways and Means Committee, knowing, Diane, what kind of administrative overhead it takes to run a agency with a 23-member board. I think if we talk to the Legislative Fiscal Office, with all the staff that they have, they have to deal with 20 members who are assigned to the full Ways and Means Committee.
Well, you know,
I would find it at least somewhat similar. Maybe not quite as similar. But.
And, Mr. Chair, I just have to say, you know, that when we put our people, when we put members of, working members of our union on a board, we're almost unilaterally expected to pay for or reimburse the agency for lost time and travel. And, you know, that has never been an issue for our union. We are willing to do that because it's the right thing to do. And because we think it is so important to have our members on there in a equal capacity. But, you know, when you look at 23 members and they're all management, I'd just like to know who's paying for them. Thank you, Mary.
But I would be interested in the administrative cost of administering a 23-member board from the Ways and Means perspective. Is there anything further? I apologize that I missed a great deal of the public testimony. Is there anything further that questions that, as a result of public testimony, any of the committee members would like the agency to respond to? All right. Now, at this point in time, I will close the public hearing. And
5049.
What's that?
On 5049.
Yeah. I'm going to close the public hearing on 5049. Tomorrow, we're going to be starting the Criminal Justice Commission tomorrow. And we don't have clear direction as to whether we're going to do the priority list Thursday or Monday. So do that. Where are we at on the corrections?
The write-up.
Overview?
It's in Kim's desk.
Okay.
So.
We'll try and extract the overview from the Department of Corrections that Doug has put together from Ken Rocco's desk. All right. Thank you. We're done.